His first action was to push her into his study and slam the door, as if to hide them both. He could no longer say from whom. An unadmitted rage was boiling in his mind, struggling between escape and explosion, and it blew up into the sensation that this negligible little wife of his was depriving him of his triumph, that he would not surrender to her his new enjoyment. "Sure," he screamed. "So what? What are you going to do about it?" She stared at him blankly. "Sure, I was there with a woman. That's what I did, because that's what I felt like doing. Do you think you're going to scare me with your gasps, your stares, your whimpering virtue?" He snapped his fingers. "That for your opinion. I don't give a hoot in hell about your opinion. Take it and like it." It was her white, defenseless face that drove him on, lashing him into a state of pleasure. The pleasure of feeling as if his words were blows, disfiguring a human face. "Do you think you're going to make me hide? I'm sick of having to put on an act for your righteous satisfaction. Who the hell are you, you cheap little nobody? I'll do as I please, and you'll keep your mouth shut and go through the right tricks in public like everybody else, and stop demanding that I act in my own home. Nobody is virtuous in his own home. The show is only for company, but if you expect me to mean it, to mean it, you damn little fool, you'd better grow up in a hurry." It was not her face that he was seeing. It was the face of the man at whom he wanted and would never be able to throw his deed of this night. But she had always stood as the worshipper, the defender, the agent of that man in his eyes. He had married her for it, so she could serve his purpose now. And he screamed, "Do you know who she was? The woman I laid? It was..." "No," she cried. "Jim, I don't have to know. It was Mrs. Reardon. Mrs. Hank Reardon." She stepped back. He felt a brief flash of terror, because she was looking at him as if she were seeing that which had to remain unadmitted to himself. She asked in a dead voice that had the incongruous sound of common sense, "I suppose you will now want us to get divorced?" He burst out laughing.
"You goddamn fool! You still mean it. You still want it big and pure. I wouldn't think of divorcing you, and don't go imagining that I'll let you divorce me. You think it's as important as that? Listen, you fool, there isn't a husband who doesn't sleep with other women, and there isn't a wife who doesn't know it, but they don't talk about it. I'll lay anybody I please, and you go and do the same, like all those bitches, and keep your mouth shut."
He saw the sudden startling sight of a look of hard, unclouded, unfeeling, almost inhuman intelligence in her eyes. "Jim, if I were the kind who did or would, you wouldn't have married me."
"No, I wouldn't have."
"Why did you marry me?" He felt himself drawn as by a whirlpool, part in relief that the moment of danger was past, part in irresistible defiance of the same danger.
"Because you were a cheap, helpless, preposterous little gutter snipe who'd never have a chance at anything to equal me. Because I thought you'd love me. I thought you'd know that you had to love me."
"As you are?"
"Without daring to ask what I am, without reasons. Without putting me on the spot, always to live up to reason after reason after reason, like being on some goddamn dress parade to the end of my days."
"You loved me because I was worthless?"
"Well, what did you think you were?"
"You loved me for being rotten?
What else did you have to offer? But you didn't have the humility to appreciate it. I wanted to be generous. I wanted to give you security. What security is there in being loved for one's virtues? The competition's wide open, like a jungle marketplace. A better person will always come along to beat you. But I was willing to love you for your flaws, for your faults and weaknesses, for your ignorance, your crudeness, your vulgarity. And that's safe. You'd have nothing to fear, nothing to hide. You could be yourself, your real stinking, sinful, ugly self. Everybody's self is a gutter. But you could hold my love, with nothing demanded of you."
"You wanted me to accept your love as alms?"
"Did you imagine that you could earn it? Did you imagine that you could deserve to marry me, you poor little tramp? I used to buy the likes of you for the price of a meal. I wanted you to know with every step you took, with every mouthful of caviar you swallowed, that you owed it all to me, that you had nothing and were nothing and could never hope to equal, deserve, or repay."
"I tried to deserve it."
"Of what use would you be to me if you had?"
"You didn't want me to?"
"Oh, you goddamn fool."
"You didn't want me to improve?"
You didn't want me to rise? You thought me rotten, and you wanted me to stay rotten?
Of what use would you be to me if you earned it all? And I had to work to hold you, and you could trade elsewhere if you chose.
You wanted it to be alms, for both of us and from both. You wanted us to be two beggars chained to each other?
Yes, you goddamned evangelist. Yes, you goddamn hero worshiper, yes.
You chose me because I was worthless?
Yes.
You're lying, Jim.
His answer was only a startled glance of astonishment.
Those girls that you used to buy for the price of a meal? They would have been glad to let their real selves become a gutter. They would have taken your alms and never tried to rise, but you would not marry one of them. You married me, because you knew that I did not accept the gutter inside or out, that I was struggling to rise and would go on struggling. Didn't you?
Yes,
he cried. Then the headlight she had felt rushing upon her hit its goal. And she screamed in the bright explosion of the impact. She screamed in physical terror, backing away from him. What's the matter with you? He cried, shaking, not daring to see in her eyes the thing she had seen. She moved her hands in groping gestures, half waving it away, half trying to grasp it. When she answered, her words did not quite name it, but they were the only words she could find.
You're a killer. For the sake of killing.
It was too close to the unnamed. Shaking with terror, he swung out blindly and struck her in the face. She fell against the side of an armchair, her head striking the floor. But she raised her head in a moment and looked up at him blankly without astonishment, as if physical reality were merely taking the form she had expected. A single pear-shaped drop of blood went slithering slowly from the corner of her mouth. He stood motionless, and for a moment they looked at each other, as if neither dared to move. She moved first. She sprang to her feet and ran. She ran out of the room, out of the apartment. He heard her running down the hall, tearing open the iron door of the emergency stairway, not waiting to ring for the elevator. She ran down the stairs, opening doors on random landings, running through the twisting hallways of the building, then down the stairs again until she found herself in the lobby and ran to the street. After a while, she saw that she was walking down a littered sidewalk in a dark neighborhood, with an electric bulb glaring in the cave of a subway entrance, and a lighted billboard advertising soda crackers on the black roof of a laundry. She did not remember how she had come here. Her mind seemed to work in broken spurts without connections. She knew only that she had to escape, and that escape was impossible. She had to escape from Jim, she thought. Where? She asked, looking around her with a glance like a cry of prayer. She would have seized upon a job in a 5 and 10, or in that laundry, or in any of the dismal shops she passed. But she would work, she thought, and the harder she worked, the more malevolence she would draw from the people around her, and she would not know when truth would be expected of her and when a lie. But the stricter her honesty, the greater the fraud she would be asked to suffer at their hands. She had seen it before and had borne it in the home of her family, in the shops of the slums. But she had thought that these were vicious exceptions, chance evils, to escape and forget. Now she knew that they were not exceptions, that theirs was the code accepted by the world, that it was a creed of living known by all, but kept unnamed, leering at her from people's eyes in that sly, guilty look she had never been able to understand. And at the root of the creed, hidden by silence, lying in wait for her in the cellars of the city and in the cellars of their souls, there was a thing with which one could not live. Why are you doing it to me? She cried soundlessly to the darkness around her. Because you're good. Some enormous laughter seemed to be answering from the rooftops and from the sewers. Then I won't want to be good any longer. But you will. I don't have to. You will. I can't bear it. You will. She shuddered and walked faster. But ahead of her in the foggy distance, she saw the calendar above the roofs of the city. It was long past midnight, and the calendar said August 6th. But it seemed to her suddenly that she saw September 2nd written above the city in letters of blood, and she thought, if she worked, if she struggled, if she rose, she would take a harder beating with each step of her climb, until at the end, whatever she reached, be it a copper company or an unmortgaged cottage, she would see it seized by Jim on some September 2nd, and she would see it vanish to pay for the parties where Jim made his deals with his friends.
"Then I won't," she screamed, and whirled around and went running back along the street.
But it seemed to her that in the black sky, grinning at her from the steam of the laundry, there weaved an enormous figure that would hold no shape, but its grin remained the same on its changing faces. And its face was Jim's, and her childhood preacher's, and the woman social workers from the personnel department of the 5 and 10,
and the grin seemed to say to her, "People like you will always stay honest. People like you will always struggle to rise. People like you will always work. So we're safe, and you have no choice."
She ran. When she looked around her once more, she was walking down a quiet street past the glass doorways where lights were burning and the carpeted lobbies of luxurious buildings. She noticed that she was limping and saw that the heel of her pump was loose. She had broken it somewhere in her blank span of running. From the sudden space of a broad intersection, she looked at the great skyscrapers in the distance. They were vanishing quietly into a veil of fog, with the faint breath of a glow behind them, with a few lights, like a smile of farewell. Once they had been a promise, and from the midst of the stagnant sloth around her, she had looked to them for proof that another kind of men existed. Now she knew that they were tombstones, slender obelisks, soaring in memory of the men who had been destroyed for having created them. They were the frozen shape of the silent cry that the reward of achievement was martyrdom. Somewhere in one of those vanishing towers, she thought, there was Dagny. But Dagny was a lonely victim, fighting a losing battle, to be destroyed and to sink into fog like the others. "There is no place to go," she thought, and stumbled on. "I can't stand still, nor move much longer. I can neither work nor rest. I can neither surrender nor fight. But this is what they want of me. This is where they want me. Neither living nor dead, neither thinking nor insane, but just a chunk of pulp that screams with fear to be shaped by them as they please, they who have no shape of their own." She plunged into the darkness behind a corner, shrinking in dread from any human figure. "No," she thought, "they're not evil, not all people. They're only their own first victims. But they all believe in Jim's creed, and I can't deal with them once I know it. And if I spoke to them, they would try to grant me their goodwill, but I'd know what it is that they hold as the good, and I would see death staring out of their eyes." The sidewalk had shrunk to a broken strip, and splashes of garbage ran over from the cans at the stoops of crumbling houses. Beyond the dusty glow of a saloon, she saw a lighted sign, "Young Women's Rest Club," above a locked door. She knew the institutions of that kind and the women who ran them. The women who said that theirs was the job of helping sufferers. If she went in, she thought, stumbling past, if she faced them and begged them for help, "What is your guilt?" they would ask her. "Drink, dope, pregnancy, shoplifting?" She would answer, "I have no guilt, I'm innocent, but I'm sorry. We have no concern for the pain of the innocent." She ran. She stopped, regaining her eyesight on the corner of a long, wide street. The buildings and pavements merged with the sky, and two lines of green lights hung in open space, going off into an endless distance, as if stretching into other towns and oceans and foreign lands to encircle the earth. The green glow had a look of serenity, like an inviting, unlimited path open to confident travel. Then the light switched to red, dropping heavily lower, turning from sharp circles into foggy smears, into a warning of unlimited danger. She stood and watched a giant truck go by, its enormous wheels crushing one more layer of shiny polish into the flattened cobbles of the street. The lights went back to the green of safety, but she stood trembling, unable to move. "That's how it works for the travel of one's body," she thought. "But what have they done to the traffic of the soul? They have set the signals in reverse, and the road is safe when the lights are the red of evil. But when the lights are the green of virtue, promising that yours is the right of way, you venture forth and are ground by the wheels." All over the world, she thought, those inverted lights go reaching into every land. They go on encircling the earth, and the earth is littered with mangled cripples who don't know what has hit them or why, who crawl as best they can on their crushed limbs through their lightless days with no answer save that pain is the core of existence. And the traffic cops of morality chortle and tell them that man, by his nature, is unable to walk. These were not words in her mind. These were the words which would have named, had she had the power to find them, what she knew only as a sudden fury that made her beat her fists in futile horror against the iron post of the traffic light beside her, against the hollow tube where the hoarse, rusty chuckle of a relentless mechanism went grating on and on. She could not smash it with her fists. She could not batter one by one all the posts of the street stretching off beyond eyesight. As she could not smash that creed from the souls of the men she would encounter one by one. She could not deal with people any longer. She could not take the paths they took. But what could she say to them, she who had no words to name the things she knew and no voice that people would hear? What could she tell them? How could she reach them all? Where were the men who could have spoken? These were not words in her mind. These were only the blows of her fists against metal. Then she saw herself suddenly battering her knuckles to blood against an immovable post, and the sight made her shudder, and she stumbled away. She went on seeing nothing around her, feeling trapped in a maze with no exit. No exit, her shreds of awareness were saying, beating it into the pavements in the sound of her steps. No exit, no refuge, no signals. No way to tell destruction from safety or enemy from friend. Like that dog she had heard about, she thought. Somebody's dog in somebody's laboratory. The dog who got his signals switched on him and saw no way to tell satisfaction from torture. Saw food changed to beatings and beatings to food. Saw his eyes and ears deceiving him and his judgment futile and his consciousness impotent in a shifting, swimming, shapeless world. And gave up. Refusing to eat at that price, or to live in a world of that kind. No, was the only conscious word in her brain. No, 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 not your way, not your world. Even if this no is all that's to be left of mine. It was in the darkest hour of the night, in an alley among wharfs and warehouses, that the social worker saw her. The social worker was a woman whose gray face and gray coat blended with the walls of the district. She saw a young girl wearing a suit too smart and expensive for the neighborhood, with no hat, no purse, with a broken heel, disheveled hair, and a bruise at the corner of her mouth. A girl staggering blindly, not knowing sidewalks from pavements. The street was only a narrow crack between the sheer blank walls of storage structures, but a ray of light fell through a fog, dank with the odor of rotting water. A stone parapet ended the street on the edge of a vast black hole, merging river and sky. The social worker approached her and asked severely, "Are you in trouble?" and saw one wary eye, the other hidden by a lock of hair, and the face of a wild creature who has forgotten the sound of human voices, but listens as to a distant echo, with suspicion, yet almost with hope. The social worker seized her arm. "It's a disgrace to come to such a state. If you society girls had something to do besides indulging your desires and chasing pleasures, you wouldn't be wandering drunk as a tramp at this hour of the night. If you stopped living for your own enjoyment, stopped thinking of yourself, and found some higher—" Then the girl screamed, and the scream went beating against the blank walls of the street as in a chamber of torture, an animal scream of terror. She tore her arm loose and sprang back, then screamed in articulate sounds, "No, no, not your kind of world!" Then she ran by the sudden propulsion of a burst of power, the power of a creature running for its life. She ran straight down the street that ended at the river, and in a single streak of speed, with no break, no moment of doubt, with full consciousness of acting in self-preservation, she kept running till the parapet barred her way, and not stopping, went over into space. Chapter 5. Their Brother's Keepers. On the morning of September 2nd, a copper wire broke in California, between two telephone poles by the track of the Pacific Branch line of the Taggart Transcontinental. A slow, thin rain had been falling since midnight, and there had been no sunrise, only a gray light seeping through a soggy sky. and the brilliant raindrops hanging on the telephone wires had been the only sparks glittering against the chalk of the clouds, the lead of the ocean, and the steel of the oil derricks descending as lone bristles down a desolate hillside. The wires had been worn by more rains and years than they had been intended to carry. One of them had kept sagging through the hours of that morning under the fragile load of raindrops. Then its one last drop had grown on the wire's curve, and it hung like a crystal bead, gathering the weight of many seconds. The bead and the wire had given up together, and as soundless as the fall of tears, the wire had broken and fallen with the fall of the bead. The men at the division headquarters of Taggart Transcontinental avoided looking at one another when the break of the telephone line was discovered and reported. They made statements painfully miscalculated to seem to refer to the problem, yet to state nothing, none fooling the others. They knew that copper wire was a vanishing commodity, more precious than gold or honor. They knew that the division storekeeper had sold their stock of wire weeks ago to unknown dealers who came by night and were not businessmen in the daytime, but only men who had friends in Sacramento and in Washington. Just as the storekeeper, recently appointed to the division, had a friend in New York named Cuffy Meggs, about whom one asked no questions. They knew that the man who would now assume the responsibility of ordering repairs and initiating the action which would lead to the discovery that the repairs could not be made would incur retaliation from unknown enemies, that his fellow workers would become mysteriously silent and would not testify to help him, that he would prove nothing, and if he attempted to do his job, it would not be his any longer. They did not know what was safe or dangerous these days, when the guilty were not punished, but the accusers were. And like animals, they knew that immobility was the only protection when in doubt and in danger. They remained immobile. They spoke about the appropriate procedure of sending reports to the appropriate authorities on the appropriate dates. A young roadmaster walked out of the room and out of the headquarters building to the safety of a telephone booth in a drugstore, and at his own expense, ignoring the continent and the tears of appropriate executives between, he telephoned Dagny Taggart in New York. She received the call in her brother's office, interrupting an emergency conference. The young roadmaster told her only that the telephone line was broken and that there was no wire to repair it. He said nothing else, and he did not explain why he had found it necessary to call her in person. She did not question him. She understood. "Thank you," was all that she answered. An emergency file in her office kept a record of all the crucial materials still on hand, on every division of Taggart Transcontinental. Like the file of a bankrupt, it kept registering losses, while the rare additions of new supplies seemed like the malicious chuckles of some tormentor throwing crumbs at a starving continent. She looked through the file, closed it, sighed, and said, "Montana, Eddie. Phone the Montana line to ship half their stock of wire to California. Montana might be able to last without it for another week." And as Eddie Willers was about to protest, she added, "Oil, Eddie. California is one of the last producers of oil left in the country. We don't dare lose the Pacific line." Then she went back to the conference in her brother's office. "Copper wire?" said James Taggart, with an odd glance that went from her face to the city beyond the window. "In a very short while, we won't have any trouble about copper." "What?" she asked. But he did not answer. There was nothing special to see beyond the window. Only the clear sky of a sunny day, the quiet light of early afternoon on the roofs of the city, and above them the page of the calendar saying, September 2nd. She did not know why he had insisted on holding this conference in his own office, why he had insisted on speaking to her alone, which he had always tried to avoid, or why he kept glancing at his wristwatch. "Things are, it seems to me, going wrong," he said. "Something has to be done. There appears to exist a state of dislocation and confusion tending toward an uncoordinated, unbalanced policy. What I mean is there's a tremendous national demand for transportation, yet we're losing money. It seems to me..." She sat looking at the ancestral map of Taggart Transcontinental on the wall of his office, at the red arteries winding across a yellowed continent. There had been a time when the railroad was called the blood system of the nation, and the stream of trains had been like a living circuit of blood, bringing growth and wealth to every patch of wilderness it touched. Now it was still like a stream of blood, but like the one-way stream that runs from a wound,
draining the last of a body's sustenance and life. One-way traffic, she thought indifferently. Consumers' traffic. There was train number 193, she thought. 6 weeks ago, train number 193 had been sent with a load of steel, not to Faulkton, Nebraska, where the Spencer Machine Tool Company, the best machine tool concern still in existence, had been idle for 2 weeks waiting for the shipment, but to Sand Creek, Illinois, where Confederated Machine had been wallowing in debt for over a year, producing unreliable goods at unpredictable times. The steel had been allocated by a directive which explained that the Spencer Machine Tool Company was a rich concern able to wait, while Confederated Machines was bankrupt and could not be allowed to collapse, being the sole source of livelihood of the community of Sand Creek, Illinois. The Spencer Machine Tool Company had closed a month ago. Confederated Machines had closed 2 weeks later. The people of Sand Creek, Illinois had been placed on national relief, but no food could be found for them in the empty granaries of the nation at the frantic call of the moment. So the seed grain of the farmers of Nebraska had been seized by order of the Unification Board, and train number 194 had carried the unplanted harvest and the future of the people of Nebraska to be consumed by the people of Illinois. In this enlightened age, Eugene Lawson had said in a radio broadcast, we have come at last to realize that each one of us is his brother's keeper. In a precarious period of emergency like the present, James Taggart was saying while she looked at the map, it is dangerous to find ourselves forced to miss paydays and accumulate wage arrears on some of our divisions. A temporary condition, of course, but... She chuckled. The railroad unification plan isn't working, is it, Jim? I beg your pardon? You're to receive a big cut of the Atlantic Southern's gross income out of the common pool at the end of the year. Only there won't be any gross income left for the pool to seize, will there? That's not true. It's just that the bankers are sabotaging the plan. Those bastards who used to give us loans in the old days with no security at all except our own railroad now refuse to let me have a few measly $100,000s on short term just to take care of a few payrolls when I have the entire plant of all the railroads of the country to offer them as security for my loan. She chuckled. We couldn't help it, he cried. It's not the fault of the plan that some people refuse to carry their fair share of our burdens.
Jim, was this all you wanted to tell me? If it is, I'll go. I have work to do.
His eyes shot to his wristwatch.
No, no, that's not all. It's most urgent that we discuss the situation and arrive at some decision, which...
She listened blankly to the next stream of generalities, wondering about his motive. He was marking time. Yet he wasn't, not fully. She felt certain that he was holding her here for some specific purpose, and simultaneously that he was holding her for the mere sake of her presence. It was some new trait in him which she had begun to notice ever since Cheryl's death. He had come running to her, rushing, unannounced, into her apartment on the evening of the day when Cheryl's body had been found, and the story of her suicide had filled the newspapers, given by some social worker who had witnessed it. An inexplicable suicide, the newspapers had called it, unable to discover any motive.
It wasn't my fault,
he had screamed to her, as if she were the only judge whom he had to placate.
I'm not to blame for it. I'm not to blame.
He had been shaking with terror. Yet she had caught a few glances thrown shrewdly at her face, which had seemed inconceivably to convey a touch of triumph. Get out of here, Jim, was all she had to say to him. He had never spoken to her again about Cheryl, but he had started coming to her office more often than usual. He had stopped her in the halls for snatches of pointless discussions. And such moments had grown into a sum that gave her an incomprehensible sensation, as if while clinging to her for support and protection against some nameless terror, his arms were sliding to embrace her and to plunge a knife into her back.
I'm eager to know your views, he was saying insistently as she looked away. It is most urgent that we discuss the situation, and you haven't said anything.
She did not turn.
It's not as if there were no money to be had out of the railroad business, but...
She glanced at him sharply. His eyes scurried away.
What I mean is, some constructive policy has to be devised,
he droned on hastily.
Something has to be done. By somebody. In times of emergency,